Today, episode 2 of a two-part special looking at what we can learn from the first 100 days of the COVID-19 crisis.
In the middle of the night on March 8th, the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte went on TV. It was 68 days since the Wuhan Health Commission had announced the discovery of the mysterious virus.
Eccoci. È necessario chiarire quel che è successo.
He announced something unprecedented in Italian history. He said that up to 16 million people, that was anybody living in the region of Lombardy,
la regione Lombardia e varie province,
14 other central and northern provinces,
Reggio Emilia, Rimini, Pesaro, Urbino, Alessandria, Asti, Novara, Verbano, Cusio, Ossola,
major cities like Milan and Venice,
Treviso e Venezia,
would suddenly be under lockdown. They would need special permission to travel, schools, gyms, museums, nightclubs, and other venues would be closed. They were the most radical measures to be taken outside of China.
Grazie.
But Italy was facing an outbreak that would eventually grow to be even bigger than that one.
Giuseppe Conte's dramatic words came 68 days after China first told the world about a mysterious virus beginning to spread in the city of Wuhan. That lockdown in Italy marked the moment that everything changed for Europe. In part one, we heard what decisions countries made in the very first days of the outbreak, when for many, COVID-19 remained a distant threat. Today, The Guardian's Michael Safi and Patrick Winter look at what happened in those same countries as the virus hit. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, COVID-19, the first 100 days, part 2. Michael, before Conte announced that lockdown, it was leaked to the press, causing chaos as people scrambled to flee the region. But the very next day, Monday, the 9th of March, he would go on to lock down the entire country. He said it was Italy's darkest hour. Was Italy ready? What was happening inside its hospitals?
It was a meltdown.
Think what it's like to be a doctor or nurse in the epicenter of the epicenter. Carla Maestrini and her colleagues have lost track of the hours they're working in the intensive care unit of Cremona Hospital. Coronavirus patients are placed on their fronts while being ventilated, so gravity helps the oxygen get into their bloodstream. That's the normal protocol for a patient with acute pneumonia. But it's not working, and the staff don't know why.
I think what was most horrifying about that moment was that this wasn't a lockdown that was preventative. This wasn't something that was going to make the disease immediately go away, because it was already through the door. I mean, a certain amount of death was just locked in by that point. And so the mass quarantine he announced wasn't about just saving lives in the next 2 weeks. It was about saving lives in a month, when people who may have caught the disease later would hopefully not be catching it. So it was like Italy was standing on the edge of a shore knowing that this tsunami was coming, but it was too late to do anything about it. They would just have to take what came for the next few weeks.
The crisis has not yet peaked in Italy, but in Lombardy, frontline healthcare is already on its knees. The laundry room of this hospital is being used to treat patients. Staff working 18-hour shifts now treating their own colleagues too.
They came from here, the hospital's intensive care unit, which is on the brink of collapse. This is what it looks like when the virus overwhelms, and here in Lombardy, it's overwhelming.
Italy was caught flat-footed. There was insufficient capacity to test. There was a reluctance to lock down cities. But what we'd learned very quickly was that there was nothing exceptional about them, that what we were watching was something that was going to spread across Europe and in many places behave in the exact same way.
Marco, when you look at, you know, you're obviously and understandably preoccupied with what's happening on the ground in the hospital, in the city, in the region that you are working in. What do you say to other countries around the world?
Get prepared as soon as possible, because the only way to prevent healthcare system collapse is to enforce a lockdown as soon as possible, to increase ICU capacity, and you're using PPEs, personal protective equipment, because it's crucial, because if a lot of healthcare staff get sick in the first few weeks, then you will not have anybody able to take care of the patients.
And we were watching it with horror. It feels fair to say that what was happening in Italy should have been a very clear warning sign to the other countries in Europe.
It should have been, and for some it was. I mean, within a week, Spain had implemented a similar kind of lockdown. You know, its 46 million citizens were told that they had to stay home. They could only leave for exceptional reasons. And, you know, I was working that day 75, the 15th of March, and I was reporting on the Spanish lockdown. And as I was updating the story, I was watching the death toll. At the beginning of the day, it was 144. By the end of the day, it had doubled. It was 288. At the same time, I was seeing pictures of people partying in Temple Bar in Dublin. Of young people in Florida celebrating spring break.
I get corona, I get corona. At the end of the day, I'm not going to let it stop me from partying. You know, I've been waiting. We've been waiting for Miami spring break for a while. About 2 months we've had this trip planned. 2-3 months. So we're just not even having a good time.
Yeah, I mean, we planned this a long time ago and it was kind of up in the air if we still go. But, like, we're here. I just turned 21 this year, so I'm here to party. So it's kind of disappointing. But we're just making the most of it. We met these other people in our little Airbnb spot. So we're just hanging out with them and trying to get drunk before everything closes.
Beaches that were packed in Australia.
The whole social distancing thing hasn't really taken hold in Bondi just yet, I would say.
Well, it's definitely not ideal. It is a worry with so many people all together, and I do think the whole world is probably looking at us right now thinking of what a massive mistake that we're making.
And it was this strange disjunct where it felt like some parts of the world had health systems that were melting down, were locking citizens down, were preparing for this wave of mass death. And then other countries that weren't even that far from Spain and Italy seemed to be just going on as if nothing was happening. But day 75 felt like a turning point. Over the next few days, the speed of updates, the number of things that were being shut down felt like they were just increasing hour by hour. I mean, By Sunday, so day 75, Germany had closed its borders to France and Switzerland and Austria. By the following day, day 76, the worldwide death toll had crossed 7,000. Canada closed its borders to all foreigners except Americans. Australia put out an unprecedented call for its citizens to return home. Iran said that they were freeing tens of thousands of prisoners. West Virginia recorded its first case of the virus, meaning all 50 American states were infected. India closed the Taj Mahal. I mean, throughout the course of that week, it just felt like the world was very, very quickly shutting down. I think what stuck with me was that, I mean, Spain started the week with, you know, a little over 6,000 cases. By the end of the week, they had 17,000.
Patrick, by then it was here. We were seeing absolutely terrifying scenes from Italy and quite quickly Spain too, of ICUs being overwhelmed. Doctors were warning that we were next. The government was still in that mitigation phase, trying to protect the vulnerable.
We should all be thinking about our elderly relatives, the more vulnerable members of our family, our neighbours, and everything we can do to protect them over the next few months.
But otherwise, letting the virus move through the population rather than suppression, trying to completely stop the virus in its tracks. And we could see that in what was essentially a keep calm and carry on, but wash your hands message.
So I'd like to end by repeating the two important messages with which you will become familiar. It is still vital, perhaps more vital than ever, that we remember to wash our hands. And lastly, of course, even if things seem tough now, just to remember that we will get through this. This country will get through this epidemic, just as it has got through many tougher experiences before, if we look out for each other and commit wholeheartedly to a full national effort.
But what was happening behind the scenes? Were people worrying about the path we were on?
Yes, I think some of the modelling was starting to change. There was a couple of things that were emerging from Italy that was making the modellers rethink the kind of advice they'd been giving. One was that the number of people in Italy that really needed quite invasive help with ventilators was much higher than they'd previously expected. And the second was that the proportion of people that were infected was higher than they'd expected. And that really started to change the model in terms of how many beds were going to be required in the NHS. And at one point, I think they came to the view that there was going to be such a sort of surge that there would be a requirement for 8 times as many beds as the NHS had available if they just carried on with this policy of mitigation rather than suppression. As the model worked out, 250,000 people would die in the UK. And I think as soon as politicians looked at that, they were really thunderstruck. One of the people I spoke to was in the room when they were discussing those numbers, said that the whole argument, the faction that had been highlighting the problems to the economy if they went straight to suppression, really collapsed. And in particular, the Health Secretary Hancock was insistent that Boris Johnson had to follow this advice and had to act upon it. I'm told that Boris Johnson really did respect the scientific advice, but there was an instinct inside him, which is a twofold instinct. One was certain things that were going to be proposed were sort of un-British. They weren't what he regarded as the liberal kind of country he'd come to love. He just thought that they somehow breached those kind of moral boundaries. And the second thing was he just thought possibly the public would not wear it. And he's a man who does care about his own popularity deeply. And he was worried particularly that voters in the North would find it just impossible to bear and that they would see this as a London problem and that this was being imposed upon them in the North.
What were the things that Boris Johnson thought were most un-British?
Well, I'm told the two things he bridled at most was the idea that the British public would not be able to go to the pub to have a beer. And the second was when he was asked to consider the prospect of anyone leaving their home needing papers, as in they've been required in France.
What was it like in the room?
I think there was a sense of shock. This has been something that had been gradually moving towards the government, and then suddenly it was hurtling towards them at a speed, and one of them suddenly said and realised, this is probably the biggest crisis to face the UK for 50 years, and nobody demurred.
All of which explains the following dramatic week. But even then, you could sort of see that Boris Johnson was struggling with it. You could hear those liberal instincts in his tone.
Many people, including millions of fit and active people over 70, may feel, listening to what I've just said, that there is something excessive about these measures.
First on Monday, he urged people not to go to pubs, restaurants and theatres and to work from home.
We need people to start working from home where they possibly can. And you should avoid pubs, clubs, theatres and other such social venues.
But it was advice, not a demand. He didn't want to close schools, but on Wednesday he reluctantly did.
after schools shut their gates from Friday afternoon, they will remain closed for most pupils, for the vast majority of pupils, until further notice. And I'll come to...
On Thursday, he appeared frustrated as he said he didn't want to weary people with constant press conferences.
Why don't we just go straight to questions? I don't propose to spend a very long time at this particular one, since we've had about four or five of these already in the last few days, and I don't want to weary you with these occasions. Do you feel they're useful? Good. Okay.
But by Friday, his advice about not going to the pub finally turned into an order.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars, and restaurants to close tonight as soon as they reasonably can, and not to open tomorrow.
Why did he do all of that step by step rather than all at once?
It was partly they undertook quite a lot of polling, which showed actually there was a public desire for the government to take sterner measures and to be much more clear. There was a sense that the advice that they were being given was very fuzzy about what you could and couldn't do. Some pubs felt they could be open, others couldn't. And the confusion meant that there was a demand from within government and actually coming from below that greater clarity was required and there needed to be more stringent measures rather than less. There was a sense the government was adrift. Dominic Cummings, who's the Prime Minister's chief advisor and been the key figure in the Leave campaign, actually brought in some of his most trusted aides from that Leave campaign and decided they were absolutely required to clarify the messaging. And I think the yellow sign that you see in front of any government minister giving a press conference saying, stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives, that comes from a lot of focus group work, and particularly the phrase, protect the NHS, Britain's most loved institution. At that point, I think they felt they got the message right.
Yeah, and it was quickly clear why they would need that message, because over the weekend, even after everything we'd seen, streets and markets were still busy, people were still socialising in groups, all of which leads to what we see on Monday, the 23rd of March. 83 days after we first learned about this virus in China, Boris Johnson addresses the nation.
Good evening. The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades, and this country is not alone.
I think they've finally resolved in their own minds that there was no room for ambiguity and there had to be a big moment.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
And he decided to do an address to the nation, something that is very, very rarely done. It had a kind of wartime atmosphere to it.
But at present, there are just no easy options. The way ahead is hard, and it is still true that many lives will, sadly, be lost. And yet it is also true that there is a clear way through.
It was clear that the nation wanted to hear from him. 27 million people watched that broadcast, which is quite an extraordinary, extraordinary number of people. There was a sense that we were now in a collective crisis.
We will beat the coronavirus, and we will beat it together. And therefore, I urge you, at this moment of national emergency, to stay at home, protect our NHS, and save lives. Thank you.
Next, Michael Safi finds himself in the middle of the world's most draconian lockdown. But first, I want to thank you for all your support. In the middle of a global crisis like this, trusted news is more important than ever, and The Guardian is committed to providing it. Our producers here at Today in Focus, along with our reporters across the world, carry out brilliant journalism to bring you these episodes. If you'd like to support us, then please go to theguardian.com/support podcasts. Thank you so much. Michael, at this time,
during the period where everything changed in Britain. Things were also rapidly changing all over the world. You were in Jordan. What was happening there?
I think at the same like whiplash speed that everyone else experienced, Jordan's response went from 0 to 100. At 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, there were successive rounds of air raid sirens across Jordan. I mean, I've been in Jordan for 6 months. I'd never heard those air raid sirens go off. I mean, they're literally there, you know, if the city is being bombed. And so it felt like we were at war, that like we had entered an emergency. And that was the signal that the curfew had started. And that meant no one could leave their homes for any reason, not to get food, not to get medicine, and that it was indefinite. And if you broke it, you would be imprisoned for up to a year. So you'd immediately be taken to a quarantine site, and then they would decide how many months you'd do in prison. And the kind of harshness of it, I remember, was quite striking. I mean, I had left a box of Diet Cokes in the boot of the car in the driveway. I felt like a fugitive going up the stairs and looking left and right. And I mean, I actually waited till night to try and get it because I thought there's less chance of anyone seeing me. And I was probably outside the front gate for about 20 seconds, but, you know, I felt like I was committing some kind of major crime. I thought, I don't want to end up in a Middle Eastern prison for a box of Cokes.
If you were terrified to even sneak out to get Diet Cokes from your car, how were people getting food?
Well, they just weren't. I mean, for the first three or four days, we were making do with what we had. One of the things that people were particularly unhappy about was that they couldn't get cigarettes. I mean, Jordan has one of the highest smoking rates in the world. And my neighbor was telling me he only had 6 packs left. So he only had 120 cigarettes left, and he was getting anxious about what he was going to do. So within a few days, the government relented a little bit and announced a plan to use public buses to repurpose public transport to deliver bread to people. And so there were these pictures going around of, you know, Amman buses packed with loaves of bread on the seats. And it was pretty clear within a day that this just, you know, wasn't working. You know, there were videos of people mobbing these buses, trying to get the bread inside. There was reports of like black market vegetable dealers who were sneaking around the city with bags of tomatoes and eggplants. And so the government shifted slightly and said that people could now leave their house, but they'd have to be home by 6 p.m.
But interesting that they had to relax it, because as we've seen all over the world, you can put these stringent measures in place, but they only work if people behave in a certain way, if people stick to them. I mean, we've talked about that being a big part of policymaking in the UK, but through your reporting on this, is it a dilemma that's being faced across the world?
I mean, absolutely. Like, there's the sort of the textbook case of what you need to do in response to a pandemic like this one. But I think what it implies is a certain amount of trust in government and a willingness to follow the rules. And I think for a lot of places, those things just don't exist in huge measure. And then on the other hand, we see in places like India, where when a lockdown is announced, it ends up throwing tens of millions of people out onto the street because, you know, they might be sleeping in the same place that they work. And if that workplace is closed, well, they have nowhere to get food, nowhere to sleep. And so they're going to go home. They're just going to walk, in some cases, hundreds of kilometers back to their villages. And in doing so, probably help to spread the disease among those populations back home. So it's easy to look on paper and say, okay, here's the textbook response and here's what Singapore did and here's what Taiwan did. But these are very different circumstances to the ones that you find in places like India and even in places like the Middle East.
Right. So policy rubbing up against reality. And in Jordan, the original policy backfired. Does that backlash give us a glimpse into what we might see elsewhere as more lockdowns come into place or the ones that are in place last longer and longer?
So now we're 100 days into this, but potentially these kinds of lockdowns could extend for 3 months, 6 months, maybe longer. And the thing that I worry about is that at some point we might start to see a backlash to these quarantines. I mean, we're already seeing fraying around the edges, protests in parts of Italy, unrest in Tunisia, in Lebanon. I saw a video of people in the Indian state of Madhya Pradesh who were pelting government health workers when they came to their village to try and stop them from testing people there. On the other hand, you might see discontent grow in places that haven't acted as stringently as other countries. So Sweden, for example, which has implemented a comparatively relaxed regime. I mean, they've suggested people do social distancing, but haven't used the law to back it, haven't ordered people into their homes. I mean, if there's an outbreak in Sweden, that's likely to have really significant political ramifications. People will quite rightly turn to the government and say, you tried this approach and now we're dying. And so now that most countries have their particular approach in place, the question is, can they keep it up? How long can you leave people locked up in their homes before they start to protest, before they start to ignore you? And it might be because they're bored, but it could also be because they're hungry and desperate.
Patrick, let's come to the UK because things have shifted dramatically in recent days. Yesterday, the official COVID-19 death toll was almost 8,000. Today, it's likely to cross that. But as people aren't being tested outside hospitals, the real number is likely to be significantly higher. And worryingly, a report this week suggested that we could be on track to have the worst outbreak in Europe with three times as many deaths as in Italy, although I should say British scientists are quite sceptical about that research. Their estimates are much lower. And then, of course, the shocking news earlier this week that Prime Minister Boris Johnson had been admitted into intensive care himself with COVID-19. He was moved out of there last night, but he's presumably still pretty unwell. And it was a very scary moment. How did people inside government react to that? And what's happening now? What's the mood?
Well, I think, first of all, they are shell-shocked by the Prime Minister's deterioration and the need for him to go to hospital. I think that was not just him, but almost like the command and control headquarters of Downing Street has been hit by this virus. And it's required a kind of reworking of government to deal with his absence. One of those issues that I think number 10 is having to examine great care is how do they extricate themselves from this? And this leads to this kind of debate between those who say we have to take account of the state of the economy, the collapse in the economy, and those who say, no, our absolute priority must be the health of the nation. That requires big judgments, and it also requires a big figure at the top of government to adjudicate between those, say, in the Department of Health and those in the Treasury. And that's the real absence and the vacuum in number 10 at present. And it can only be filled by the return of the Prime Minister. So that's the first thing that's happened. The second is there is still concern at the pace with which this virus is ripping through the UK. And it is inevitable that every country is looking to the performance and the effectiveness of other countries to see whether they are either done something wrong in the past or whether there's anything they can learn for the future. There'll be a kind of moment, a reckoning, when people will, when this is all over, decide which country responded best.
And look, I don't want to be unfair. No one envies people having to make these incredibly high-stakes decisions. We haven't seen a pandemic like this
in our lifetimes, and it's incredibly difficult to know what is the right thing to do. But it does feel to me as if what we've seen in terms of COVID-19 hitting government itself in a way mirrors a possible wider criticism of the British approach, that in the same way that the measures brought in to protect the health of those leading figures, remote press conferences and cabinet meetings, for example, came in a step too late, so did the broader strategy. Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty admitted that Germany's quick action on mass testing, for example, is something we must learn from.
Well, I think that the one thing I'd add to that is we all know that Germany got ahead in terms of its ability to do testing for the virus. And there's a lot to learn from that. And we've been trying to learn the lessons from that.
On that, on testing, but on all of this, including the lockdown itself, were we just a bit too late?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I think what's clear is that there's a lack of protective equipment on the front line for health service staff, and I think that is unforgivable. I think the whole question of ventilators has also been an issue which should have been addressed earlier, and it was always unclear why they suddenly asked for a new manufacturer to come forward for ventilators when there were some existing firms, and they should have been contacted earlier and asked to ramp up their production. And I think this whole issue of testing has been a mess. I think also there's been a strange uncertainty about the relationship between the politicians and the experts, the scientists. I mean, this is a government that famously said we'd had enough of experts, but actually these very same people who made those remarks are now constantly saying they must follow the scientific advice. And if anything, they've tipped over into sort of idolising these scientists. The scientists themselves say to the politicians, please don't take everything we say as gospel. The science is changing. Some of us disagree with one another anyway. And when we say, for instance, it would be ideal if only 20% of school children were left in school, we were not absolutely being rigorous about this. You're repeating my mantra over and over. It was just almost a passing remark, which you're turning into a sort of shibboleth. So there's been a kind of learning process between the scientists and the politicians about how they should work with one another in a crisis like this.
Patrick, it may be too early to ask what this all means for this government in the future and for Britain in the future. But one thing is clear, a reckoning will come. And it seems to me increasingly clear that ministers and officials are aware of that. Do you think they are? And do you think that's affecting how they behave?
Yes, I think, I mean, obviously to review this now is like the equivalent of reviewing a play after the second scene of the first act. But I think all politicians, and this is true across the globe, have got one eye on the hand-to-hand combat which they're undertaking now, and their other eye is what this is going to bequeath both for themselves in terms of their reputations, but also in terms of the kind of societies they will try to govern thereafter. In Whitehall, there's a lot of effort to make sure that everything is put down on paper as much as possible, because there will be a commission of inquiry into how this happened and how it was handled, and there should be. And who will come out with their reputations burnished or damaged is going to affect the country for a decade or more.
Michael, it's now 100 days since China first went to the World Health Organization about a new virus. Where's the story of COVID-19 going next?
Well, we've seen it over those 100 days shift from a Chinese story to a European story, from Italy to Spain. I mean, now the UK is facing its worst week. It's become an American story. The US now makes up, you know, the plurality of the world's cases. From there's lots of possibilities, none of them good. What it's done so far is ravaged the global north, rich, relatively developed countries. The next stage could see the virus shift into the global south, countries like India, which bore the brunt of the Spanish flu 100 years ago, you know, hugely stretched health system, a population, many of whom have compromised lung capacity because of issues like air pollution, We've already had deaths in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, we learned that the Central African Republic has three ventilators, three. I mean, if the disease breaks out there, if it breaks out in massive refugee communities in Bangladesh, in the Middle East, we could see sickness on the scale of what we've seen in Italy without anything approaching the kind of health system that was put into action there.
Wow. We began this story in China and then in other places in East Asia. And I want to go back there. What's happening now?
Well, in China, they've started to slowly lift the restrictions they put in place when the disease really broke out in their country. And they're doing that cautiously because the concern is that if they relax the restrictions and the disease comes back, then people will have to go back to their homes. And we sort of have to go back to the drawing board to figure out, well, you know, what do you do next? And we're already seeing signs of that kind of second wave of the disease in places like Hong Kong and Singapore, where it's thought to be carried by people who left those countries when the virus first broke out and who are now returning back from their home countries thinking that, you know, Singapore is now safe, except, you know, they might come carrying the disease. I mean, they're the ones who are now making it unsafe. And so the next few weeks and months will be this process of just tentatively, you know, relaxing and seeing what that does and hoping that the disease does go. Because if it doesn't, then it means that we're likely going to be living under some form of lockdown regime for months to come at least, and maybe until a vaccine can be found for this virus.
Michael, I know it's early days, really, in the story of COVID-19 and very difficult to draw conclusions at this stage. But one thing that you've mentioned that's interested me is the way that early intervention by a country clearly has a big impact, but also that different countries used different forms of intervention. So some of them had very, very draconian lockdowns. Others, like you mentioned, South Korea, had much, much more targeted efforts where testing seemed to be key. Is there any way to say at this stage which of these measures is most effective?
Well, it's impossible to say for certain. I mean, we're all involved in this gigantic public health experiment now, whether we like it or not. But I think what's clear from the examples of countries like Singapore, like Korea, like Taiwan, that whatever you do, you need to do it quickly. I mean, as fast as you can. And we have a sense of what works. It's contact tracing, it's isolating infected populations and the vulnerable, and it's social distancing. And it's early days, but my bet is at the end of this, we'll see that the countries that did that most quickly will be the ones that averted the worst.
That was The Guardian's international correspondent Michael Safi and diplomatic editor Patrick Winter. Thanks to both of them for their brilliant journalism. Do go to theguardian.com to read their reporting. Michael has written a piece all about the first 100 days. Do also follow this story on our rolling live blog. And do listen to Science Weekly, which is out 3 times a week. I hope you enjoyed these 2 episodes. Thanks again for all the kind reviews about Today in Focus. As I've said before, they are a huge morale boost to a team that is working hard remotely to keep bringing you episodes throughout this crisis, so keep them coming. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly, with additional research by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Happy Easter. I hope you have a great weekend. Stay safe. We'll be back on Monday.